It would be lovely to be able to do what you wanted, always do what you like. Life isn't really like that, is it? This week, there are things I'd like to have done I haven't done. And we talk about freedom, and our subject tonight is slavery and freedom. It seems that because of our nature, because of life, because of life is, there are curtailments and limitations in some way on our freedoms. We'd like to do things, but we can't. We hit up against a brick wall sometimes. We talked about this the other day when we talked about Paul, how Paul said, Satan prevented me. As if there's certain things, there's a certain line beyond which you cannot press. We have to accept that we can't do everything. And as I was preparing tonight, there are things I might wanted to do and wanted to say, but I'm just going to open up the subject, and maybe what we'll do is, consequent to what I have to say to you, we may have an opportunity to talk about it a little bit and ask some questions and open it up a little bit further if time allows. But the passage we've been reading, I don't know how you felt as you were reading through the passage, which particular subjects struck you or verses struck you. Maybe it just went straight over your head. But one of the things that strikes me in there is around verse 44 following, where we have to accept that in this passage here, the whole general passage is about freedom and redemption and keeping people from poverty and the worst excesses of poverty and doing everything you can for your brother to try and keep them at their liberty and returning them to their land and so on and so forth. But there in verse 44, there is a final acceptance of the condition of poverty, of slavery. There are people there in the passage described as slaves, people who will have no apparent prospect of ever being freed. That's there in the passage. And that, I think, should provoke us in some way, shape, or form to think and reflect. Because that is a fairly substantial thing to be confronted with. I don't know how good your history is, but people like Wilberforce, you probably know men like Wilberforce, who were these evangelical Christians, of whom there was a number, who became the spearhead of a movement in this country to form the abolition of slavery. Firstly, the abolition of the slave trade. Got to stop the trade first. And once the trade is stopped, then there was the whole business of actually setting the slaves free. And, of course, that process went on. It went into the American Civil War. It's been a long, protracted, just that particular example of slavery. You've still got Martin Luther King just, 50 years ago, or whatever, it's still involved in the whole process, that there's still the overhang and of slavery and the racism and the class system that comes consequent to it, even after people are formally freed and so on. I mean, it's a long business, it's a deep business, and people like Wilberforce gave their lives essentially, finally, to this one single issue, that the slave should be free. That the slave should be free. And around about that time, people like Wilberforce, was it Isaac Newton said, if I've seen further than others, it's because I stood on the shoulders of giants. Whatever scientific discoveries he made them because people had already been doing the work beforehand. And likewise, Wilberforce was not an isolated man just popped out of nowhere, no more than Nelson Mandela is the only reason that South Africa eventually changed its laws and so on and so forth. There's a whole group of people in history, and I would say the great outpouring, the great awakening, the spiritual awakening, the evangelical awakening that took place in this country in the 1730s, 1740s, which gave birth to what we now call Methodism. We can hardly sometimes relate the Methodism of today, perhaps you need to understand, if you read about the Methodism of the 1740s, you have got the most vibrant, self-sacrificing, courageous, life-transforming, nation-transforming revival of the Christian faith. And probably one of the most the flowering of the preaching of the gospel in the English language at its highest point, its highest level. Men like Wesley, men like Whitfield, people like that. Whitfield gets a little bit overlooked by history. We know more about Wesley because the denomination took his name. Whitfield formed no denomination. But if you'd been alive in his day, it was Whitfield. That was the name on everyone. He was the most famous man in the English-speaking world at the time. And hardly surprising, because these men and others like them traveled the length and the breadth of Britain and America and so on and so forth, preaching Christ, often to the disenfranchised, often to the people who never went to church, couldn't go to church, their social conditions, they were so alienated from the society that inhabited the Norman churches of the day and their pews. And actually, as we know, that part of the reason the Baptists were put out of the Church of England often is because the people whose churches it was complained that the oi polloi were scratching the pews. But for the first time here, Kingswood, not a little way from here, the coal miners who are living, spending a lot of their times just like the coal mines in Wales. Before the sun came up, they were going underground. They'd come up from the mines. Once the sun had went down, they lived 6 days out of seven in total darkness. And people like Wesley, people like Whitfield, these people were not going to come to the Church of England church. They went to them. They went to the coal mines and they preached Christ. And this great outpouring of the Holy Spirit assisted their work, and thousands and thousands and thousands of people were converted. And they went to America. They didn't just, crossing to America now is a bit of a bind, getting on an airplane, all the rest, and we complain about it all. But going to America in those days was a life and death situation. You were tossed to and fro on the Atlantic Ocean in all its ferocity for weeks and weeks, and people died in large numbers. But they went to America to preach Christ. They traveled thereabouts preaching Christ. And one of the things that started to happen is that they started to encounter significant numbers of the slaves who had been brought over from Africa to the plantations, to work the plantations. And they were treated essentially as subhumans, incapable of the ordinary responses of a civilized, decent, complete human being. But they witnessed something. As Whitfield preached to the slaves who were allowed to sit in or stand in at the back of the churches in America sometimes, they were converted. God started to work his wonders in their hearts, and they got saved. The gospel came home into their hearts. And I suppose history has got this remarkable record of how the Lord Jesus Christ has worked wonderfully in the African-American people against all manner of social prejudices and so on, so forth, and sustained them in many wonderful ways. But let me say this, the whole issue of slavery increasingly became the big controversy. They were talking about Christ and they were arguing, there was much theological controversy. So one of the big controversies that blew up, and Whitfield and Wesley sadly would often have more than one falling out on various different points, but one of the principal departures that they had from one another was on the matter of slavery. They disagreed fundamentally, or apparently disagreed fundamentally, on the subject of slavery. So if I read you something that Whitfield wrote, for example, Whitfield advocated slavery. And you should rightly find that appalling, that such a prominent minister of the gospel was an advocate of slavery. His main work was to advocate that the slaves should be treated with the utmost dignity, that their conditions should be improved as much as could be possible, that every possibility should be made for their religious education, that they should be allowed to go to church, that Christ should be preached to them, that they had have opportunities to learn to read so they could read their Bibles. He wanted to improve their conditions. But he did not believe it was the Christian's moral right or responsibility to try to abolish slavery. He says, for example, it's true, they were brought in a wrong way from their own country. It's a trade not to be approved of. Yes, but it will be carried on whether we will it or not. And I should think myself highly favored if I could purchase a good number of them in order to make their lives comfortable, lay a foundation for breeding up their posterity in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. So he's saying, look, it happens, folks. This is the real world. And if this is how it is, I want a part of it, and I want to bring Christ into that situation. That's basically what he's saying. And then you take Wesley. Now, Wesley took a very different view. Wesley said, hang on, if these people can be converted, if these people have the capacity for becoming Christians, then how can we keep our fellow Christians as slaves? And those who have not been converted, how can, if they have the capacity for Christ, surely they have the same human dignities as the rest of us. How can we allow slavery to continue? They are men, and we must treat them as men. Here he is. Give liberty to all whom liberty is due, and that is to every child born of man, to every partaker of human nature. Let none serve you, but by his own act, by his own deed, by his own voluntary action. Away with whips and chains and all compulsion. Be gentle to all men, and see that you invariably do unto others as you would have them do unto you. I'm sure us as modern Christians all warm to that perspective, that point of view. And of course, in the reality of the situation, that is the point of view that finally triumphed. Wilberforce and the rest of them triumphed in the Parliament, and the acts were passed, and so on and so forth. And that is how history played itself out. You could say that Whitfield was a pragmatist. He believed this is the real world, and we've got to take real steps in the real world. Whereas Wesley's the idealist. He's saying, this is how it should be. This is what the kingdom should look like, and we've got to strive towards that, not give up, and not give up the principle. They seem to be attacking the problem from two different points of view. That's history. But according to a conservative estimate, there are today between 21 and 30 million people living in slavery today. And that means that there are more people living in slavery today than at any other time in the whole of human history. And slavery has existed for thousands of years, but changes in the world's economy and societies over the last 50 years have enabled a mass resurgence of slavery in the world today. We've been shocked recently, haven't we, about people being set free from houses in London. They're slaves in this country. And although the political battle was fought and won back in the 1800s, human trafficking is taking place on an enormous scale that puts what took place in those times into the shade. So as Christians, this subject has not gone away. The subject has not gone away. And we as Christians need to position ourselves and be able to speak and advocate appropriately in this day and age. And this passage in Leviticus is often referred to and cited because in this passage it deals with slavery. It deals with the processes that happen. People fall into poverty, the trap of poverty. And though their community and their society may do all they can to try and mitigate that and set into action things that can prevent them and to keep them, ultimately it recognizes that some people end up in a situation where the relationship between them and other people is the situation of slavery. They have no power. And somebody else has the power. And that's the circumstance that they find themselves in. And that word slave that gets translated slave, there is a lot of ink spilled over this word that gets translated slave. It's the Hebrew word eved. Eved. And if you trace this word eved through the Bible, you'll see it's translated in all sorts of different ways. In one place, you're going to find it translated as the word slave. In other places, you're going to find it translated as the word servant. And straight away you can see there's a world of difference in those two translations. Sometimes it's translated as a subject. So if there's a king or an authority, a person, the subjects, they are described as the servants of the king, the eved of the king. That doesn't mean necessarily they are in chains and being whipped and under compulsions. It just means that that is the nature of their relationship. They are his servants. And an official, a royal official, even a high-ranking official, in fact, if you can think, what is the highest praise in the whole of Scripture? A title even of the Messiah. It's the servant of the Lord, isn't it? The Eved of the Lord. So on the one hand, it's this word Eved describes the person in the most demeaned situation in the whole of society. But the same word has been used to describe the person who has the most elevated position of them all. In both ends, you've got the Eved. And so this is a very difficult subject. But I think in the end, if we're trying to understand this word, it's about the relationship, this bond that exists between these two individuals, this relationship that exists between the two of them, where one of them, either voluntarily or involuntarily, has to devote themselves entirely, their thoughts, their ideas, their work, their labor, to somebody else's interests and not to their own. They have no scope to look to their own interests. They can't protect themselves. They can't work for themselves. They can't further their own interests. Their whole life is to further the interests of another. And they are vulnerable then to the person who is their custodian, their master, to look to their welfare, that they cannot save or help themselves. They are totally dependent on this person, whoever that person is, to protect them, to provide for them, to treat them as they will. And there is nothing they can do about it. That's just there, whether you are the servant of the Lord or whether you are a person at the bottom end of society who's run out of road and you become the servant of your neighbor. And this passage talks all about how we can alleviate the conditions that tend towards slavery. Slavery is not a desirable situation or arrangement to find. Liberty, freedom is the ideal situation so that arrangements and relationships can be voluntary, something that people enter into freely. But the fact is that the real reason why this slavery comes about, it tends to be, is just poverty. Poverty, poverty, poverty. And that's what leads people into these things. It's good. We're going to do a course here at the church, by the way, in the new year, called the CAP course, C-A-P, Christians Against Poverty. We haven't fixed dates yet, have we? Oh, we have. Oh, well, I didn't know about that. Go for it. When is it? You see, I told you can't do everything. First week in January. 30th of January, 30th of January. Three sessions, one a week, is it? I was speaking to somebody the other night. They wanted to do the course. So, start it. And this is a course. It's a money management course. Good thing to do after Christmas, the new year, and all the rest of it. A Christian money management course. You know, if handling your finances is really, really important, isn't it? And just be able to do that and manage your situation as well. Otherwise, you just find yourself at the behest of your creditors and your debtors and all the rest of it. We'll do that here. And this passage is all about the way people offer credit to people to keep them out of poverty, give them a chance, give them a break, fresh start. In the end, though, there is still, in verse 44 onwards, these people who end up in slavery. There are people who end up in slavery. At the moment, there are between 21 and 30 million people in the world who are slaves. That's a fact. That's just a fact. You want to question that? No? It is an unbelievable fact. There's seven. Where are they? They're wage slaves in Africa. They're in Asia. They're in the Middle East. I should think they're in Russia. Some parts of Russia. Be interesting to survey it, wouldn't it? To find out where they all are. Sadly, we've discovered some of them are in England. And human trafficking, especially the sex trade and stuff like that, I think they're all over the place. Yeah, truly. Yeah. People who are not actually got shackles around their feet, but effectively the nature of the economy they're in, the debt that they're in, means that they have no power over their own life at all. Where they work, what conditions they work in, how long they work for, how they're treated. They've got no recourse, no opportunity for complaint, no rest. They are completely enslaved by their circumstances. But you know, it's always existed in one shape or form all the way through history. And it has to say that it has provided the backbone for the economies of the world. And this is a very unpleasant reality and fact. They've done the menial work. They have done the dirty jobs. The jobs that nobody wants to do. People have been forced to do jobs that nobody voluntarily. Have you noticed that when it comes to the dirty jobs, it's much harder to find the people who are willing and wanting to do them? You know, you don't get a whole line of volunteers, generally speaking, do you? What do we teach our kids? You've got to do something you enjoy when you grow up. Think of, find something you're really going to be fulfilling. Fulfill yourself. Nobody's going to voluntarily say, you know, when you grow up, I want you to break rocks for a living. That'd be great. It'd be totally miserable, and you'll do it for hours and hours on end. And people have been forced to do the menial work. But you know, it's interesting with slavery as well. It's not just the menial work. Slaves, at different times of history, have risen right up and have performed political tasks, almost like prime minister. Think of Joseph in the Bible, in the Old Testament. He was the prime minister. The man was a slave. He ran a prison. There was a point where, in the Roman world, all the ship captains were slaves. They were the captains of their own ships, but they were slaves. All the big farms that were owned by the big families, there were slaves who ran the farms. They had apparent wealth, apparent power. You know, sometimes Caesars would adopt slaves as their own children and bring them up as their own children. If one of them suited and liked them and was better suited to government than some of their own natural relatives, they would formalize the adoption and call them their son, and they would set them free and become their heirs. So slaves have been working at all sorts of levels at different times around the world. And the fact is that the wealth, we know all these bits and bobs that come from China and come from India and the clothes that we wear, and we're so conscious of it, aren't we? The Nike and the bit parts for all the computers, and there are people digging in the ground, in the mud somewhere, to mine out bits of precious metals that we need to form components in something that we've just used for a year and throw away. And that the wealth we have to recognize that somewhere at the bottom of the economic pile, there are people who are doing the work. And they don't want to. It's not their choice. It's not what they like doing. And go to Bristol. Look at the fantastic buildings in Bristol. Big buildings in Bath. The London. The enormous buildings in London. Where did the money come from? Where did the big houses come from? The plantations and the sugar and all the other things and the gold and the slaves. You go to Germany, and there's a bridge over the Rhine in Germany. It's a huge river, the Rhine, so wide. But the Romans, in about the 1st century AD, built a bridge across that. And it's still there. Now, that's quite a bridge. To build a bridge that has lasted nearly 2,000 years. But I'll tell you who built it. Because nobody was going to volunteer to wade into those waters and lay down those bricks. Because the number of people that died is terrifying and horrifying. They were slaves. The Colosseum, all these sort of things. The great empires, the great civilizations. Slavery has played its part. Even the civilizations of Africa. They were raiding each other and taking each other's people and using them as slaves. Maybe we ought to say, you know, we're not going to get a chance to say thank you to them, are we? Because we're never going to meet them. We're not going to see them face to face. But they're there, and they always have been. And the Bible recognizes their existence and recognizes the existence of slavery. The worst thing that we can do, the worst attitude we can have to slavery, is indifference. that we really just don't care. Not interested. That is, in my view, pretty reprehensible. I don't know how we can stomach that one. Exploitative is another one. Exploiting slavery. That doesn't feature very highly on my list of moral virtues. You know what the Moravians did? You heard about the Moravians? Again, this is during the Methodist time. You heard about the Moravians, anybody? They were a group of very early Christians, mostly came from what is now the Czech Republic. They were heavily persecuted, ended up in Germany. They started a prayer meeting. That prayer meeting, do you know how long it lasted? They continually carried on a prayer meeting for 100 years. Maintained prayer amongst themselves for 100 years. Praying for missionary opportunities. Praying for church planting opportunities. And at a time when racism was absolutely sort of central to the cultural norms of Europe, they had congregations where they would have Indians and Africans and people in their own churches. You were part, both of you, weren't you? John and Jill were part of digging up a cemetery here in Wiltshire, and they discovered in there the burial of a young African woman. And as far as we know in this country, it's the first time a woman who was of African descent was buried as a Christian. Not buried in a separate compartment for slaves and the paupers, but it was a Moravian cemetery. They started to recognize people and tried to set people free. In fact, one group of young Moravian missionaries sold themselves to slave owners, boarded a ship in Holland so that they could be deported to the plantations in the Caribbean, where no Christian missionary or minister was allowed to visit the slaves. And the only way to reach them with Christ was to become slaves themselves and go amongst them and preach Christ amongst them. That's an attitude to slavery. And then there's Wilberforce, who we've been speaking about. The Bible recognizes slavery, just like the Bible recognizes murder and it recognizes divorce and all these sorts of things. These things happen. But things like divorce are concessions, aren't they? Is it the will of God that everybody get divorced and their marriages fall apart? Of course not. Is it God's will that everybody be enslaved and be treated miserably? Of course not. Does it happen? It happens. And the Bible looks this world of ours right in the eye. God looks this world in the eye. Chapter 25 is so often preached upon because it's this whole passage about freedom, setting the captives free. It's the whole passage about the Sabbath year, giving the land rest. It's the whole passage about the year of Jubilee every 50 years. Go back to your homes. All these wonderful themes of freedom, general redemption, but still at the same time with all this freedom of hope. I don't think we often look at the passage and look at it in this different way and see there are some for whom there is, those hopes do not exist. They do not exist. And Jesus, when he came, preached the acceptable year of the Lord, freedom for the captives. And it seems there are some who will never go free. And we're warned in Leviticus chapter 26, verse 35, that if we exploit human beings, if we exploit the earth, if we run it down, it will come back on us so terribly. It will be us that lose our opportunities, our land. We will lose our freedom. If we take freedom from others, if we take rest from others, in the end, it will be recouped from us. It says, verse 53, do not deal ruthlessly. Do not deal ruthlessly. But it ultimately does not say you will never have a relationship to somebody who is a slave, or that there will never be somebody in this world who is not a slave and has a relationship to others who are not. That exists. That exists. And we want prosperity. We want a great country. We want a great culture. We want happiness. We want people to have freedoms and liberties. We should do everything we can in our power to ensure that for anybody and everybody. And just as we are treated fairly and well by God, surely we should do everything we can to deal with others as fairly and as well as we can in his name. There's nothing wrong with being rich. There's nothing wrong with having power. The fact is, every one of us here in this room, you are so powerful. I know I repeat, some of you haven't been to these services very often, but these guys who come a lot, they know I repeat my stories often. You know, one of the stories I repeat often is the story of getting into a car park out of the supermarket one time. I had about two children that time and had a BMW which was given to me by my firm. And I opened the boot of my car and I loaded about 8 or 10 bags of shopping into the boot of my car. And as I was putting all this stuff in the boot of the car, it suddenly dawned on me, and I was moaning and complaining, you know, about the price. I'm amongst the top 5% wealthiest people in the world today. I think if you've got a decent job in this country, you're probably amongst the upper margins of the world's population in terms of affluence, power, opportunity, education, health, and the rest of it. We are, in that regard, a blessed people, aren't we? And that must have its dangers, because the danger is we look at all the people who've got more than us and we can get so greedy, we spend our whole lives just trying to go up the next line, and the people down there are being trodden more and more down by our activity to do so. That this power we've got has also got its responsibilities, hasn't it? We have got responsibilities as well as opportunities. What can we do for the poor? What can we do for the weary? What can we do? I mean, peace on earth, goodwill to all men. What? That's to all men. To all men. But here are these people in verse 44. Is the Bible finally condoning what is evil? This is what I'm kind of rounding up to. Does the stance of the Bible on slavery show that actually the Bible is morally fallible? There's a weakness, there's a moral weakness in this book. It's something indefensible. I was reading somebody who's criticizing the Bible's perspective on slavery. It said, except for murder, slavery has got to be one of the most immoral things a person can do. Yet slavery is rampant throughout the pages of the Bible, in the Old and the New Testaments. You'll get accused of this as Christians. If you actually get out there and start talking to people about your faith, at some point, you will come across somebody who will say, yeah, well, the Bible condones slavery. Let me assure you, it will happen if you get out there long enough. It will come up, okay? The Bible clearly approves of slavery in many passages, and it goes as far as to tell you how to obtain slaves, how hard you're allowed to beat them, and even when you're allowed to have sexual relations with the slaves of the opposite sex if you own them. You know, these questions, you will have to find an answer if you ever put in that. So I had an eight-year-old that came to our youth club on Friday night. And I was just talking about the coming of Jesus, Christmas. It was like a kind of kiddies talk for the little ones. She put her hand up. I said, yes? She said, where did the girls come from that Cain got married to? You know, she's about 7 or 8. Because already, even at a young age, you know, probably went home and said to mum, oh, I had a really good time at club. We learnt all about Jesus and God and we prayed and stuff like that. Mum or dad probably said, you know, you go and ask the minister, where did Cain go? You know, there are classic kind of one-liners. Let me tell you, if you get out there, people will bring up the subject of slavery with you. And you can see from Whitfield and Wesley, there are different sides of the coin. And you may have your own persuasions. And you may say, well, actually, the pragmatic approach actually is right. It's just a reality. It's a reality. And we've got to somehow grapple with that reality and make it as good as it humanly can be in this fallen world and work with it. Or we say there is no principled accommodation with slavery at all. We have to abolish it. We have to work tirelessly. Wilberforce and the others, there are between 21 and 30 million slaves in the world today. We're going to have to work tirelessly as Christians, not just this church. I'm not saying the whole God, this congregation, this is our new task. I'm just, you know, the Christians everywhere are going to have to work tirelessly if we're going to push back this vast rising tide of slavery in the world today. If we're going to have goodwill to all men, we've got to think practically, what does this mean? Some people accuse us, people accuse us and say, Christians are nicer than their Bibles. You talk to the average Christian, they don't advocate slavery. Wilberforce didn't advocate slavery. Wesley didn't advocate slavery. But the Bible you read does. You're just nice people, you know, but your God is not actually that nice. And they will whittle away at you. They will whittle away at you. But this passage here asks some very important questions to the Israelites at that time. He asks them this question: who owns the land on which you live? Can anybody tell me? They're like the land of promise. Who owns it? So all these families get given their little parcel of land to live on, and they look after it, and they're allowed to go back to it. Who does the land belong to? It's God's, isn't it? That's very, very clear. And look in verse 55. The Israelites themselves, well, they are described there. They're described there as belonging to God, right? They belong to God. The land belongs to God. Their possessions belong to God. Their very lives, their souls, they belong to God. They are the servants of the Lord. And what's the word there for servant? Anybody listening at the beginning? There's a smarty for anybody who gets it right. Eved. Eved. And you can translate it how you like. And maybe sometimes trying to translate everything over is always difficult because there's the context. But in the end, they're Eveds. They're Eveds. They don't actually have final power over their lives. They can't determine what they do and what they don't do. Their lives and their possessions actually belong to somebody else. They belong to somebody else. They're not their own. And it seems to me that it's reminding them that actually, you're slaves. You're my slaves. It doesn't put it like that. But you belong to me. You've been bought with a price. I redeemed you. I took you out of Egypt. You were slaves in Egypt, and who was your master then? The Egyptians were. And I bought you. I brought you out. And who do you belong to now? Me. And what have I given you? Where have you given? You can live in my land. You can live on my land. You can work my land. And in one sense, you can see that they're being sobered to think that this whole issue of the Eved, yes, it affects the poor, but they themselves are still Eveds. So if that is just part of the human condition, there's always somebody more powerful than you. There's always somebody stronger. You can't just run your life how you like. You can't do what you want. The big question, it seems to me, is who is your master? If in one way, shape, or form we're all slaves, if you want to translate it like that, it's not the best word to use. Bond servants. If we're all bond servants to somebody or something, it seems to me the big question is, who's your master? Who's your Lord? What's he like? How does he treat you? What does he do for you? So, and that was going to determine the conditions of your life. Because if you've got somebody who's going to deal ruthlessly with you, then your life is going to be miserable. But if you've got a kind master, if you've got a good Lord, then your prospects, your condition of slavery is going to be so enormously alleviated because of the value and the virtue of the person to whom you belong. That will make all the difference. And the Bible's very clear in Romans, isn't it? That we are born as slaves to sin. Slaves to sin. And that means that through sin, Satan masters us. And I don't know about you, but that word means, it's the Greek word there, doulos. It's equal. So you can translate it servant, slave, exactly the same way. But one way or another, sin determines how you live your life. Satan runs your life. And that is the most dreadful mastery. That is the most dreadful condition for a human being to find themselves in. Because he uses you and he abuses you. And he throws you away. That's the human state in practice. And some people have got lots and lots of money, and they're very elevated, and lots of opportunities, but ultimately, Can they do what they want? Can they live the life they want to live? No, they can't. Because sin is working in their members and it prevents them. If we could just do what we wanted, where would it, if you could be anywhere in the world doing anything you liked, you're going to tell me you'd like to be here doing this, aren't you? But why is it that people have so many broken dreams and frustrated desires, and they work their lives and they try to achieve this and they don't? Why is there so many broken hearts? If we can do what we like, if we're free, why are so many people so miserable? Why is there so many tears if we're free? See, I think you look around the world, you realize people, wouldn't it be wonderful if we were? But people aren't. People aren't free. They need somebody who's going to set them free. But even when you're set free, you then, who are you going to serve? You cannot escape the fact there's always one greater. And the highest and the greatest state that any slave, like all of us, can ever be, is to be the servant of the greatest and the kindest master of them all. And to be the eved of the Lord, to be the servants of the Lord, surely must be the greatest privilege, the highest estate that any person born in slavery, living out their lives in slavery in one way, shape, or form, could ever aspire or attain to. One who loves you and cares for you, is generous and tolerant and kind, and makes you as comfortable in this world as can be. One who, if you had a choice to serve, you would serve. This is a whole big controversy. It's interesting that Whitfield and Wesley didn't just disagree about slavery. The other big issue they disagreed about was, do you know, anybody know? Kind of grace. Grace was the hinge of it, absolutely right. The freedom of the will. How free we are. And grace actually comes into that in a huge way. Whitfield advocated and believed that we can't save ourselves. We cannot choose to follow Christ. We cannot choose to do the right thing. If you become a Christian, it's because God in his mercy has sent his Spirit into your life. He's overwhelmed all your natural inclinations and the sinful nature and so on, and broken through and captured your heart. And that your salvation is of grace. It's a gift from him. He's come and rescued you from your slavery, and he's made you his servant. He's taken you for himself. Whereas Wesley believed that I have decided to follow Jesus, that the will is still free. I can choose to do the right thing. So ultimately, the danger of that view, in my opinion, in my belief, in my judgment, the danger of that is that your will, you're saying that you've contributed something to your salvation, as if you yourself have done something. I chose. Which means that fundamentally, I must be sort of good. And that he talks about human nature in terms of his whole discussion about slavery. Let's just round this up. There are lots of books in the New Testament that speak to this subject indirectly, like the book of Philemon, for example, where a young slave runs away, goes to prison, finds himself in prison next to the Apostle Paul. That's an interesting situation to find yourself in. You won't be entirely surprising to find out that he got saved. And as a consequence of that, it turns out that this slave actually belonged to a Christian, go figure, who had been one of the people that Paul had led to the Lord in a completely different part of the country. And what effectively Paul does is he writes to this man, the slave owner, and he says, this slave has come to me, and I'm sure he was totally worthless to you, and you're very cross and all the rest of it, but I'm sending him back to you. He's a new man, and he's coming back to you. There's no suggestion that he's coming back on any other terms than to be the slave of his master. But he talks to the master, and he says to him, I want you to receive him as a brother. I want you to receive him as a brother. It's worth reading Philemon. It's a very, very short letter. He doesn't tell him you've got to set him free. But he leaves the door open because actually there's nobody who can set him free but the master. Paul can argue and tell him what to do and all the rest of it. The law was in his hands. That was the reality of the situation. Onesimus was a slave. And if he was going to be free, it's because his master set him free, because he'd come to love him and chooses to do so. Doesn't tell him what to do. But I think personally, what does the Bible teach on? I think we have to set people free if we can. And I think Wesley was right that we have to give dignity to all and all these sort of things. I agree. But sometimes we find ourselves in situations where there is nothing we can do except for make those conditions as good and as favorable and as well disposed as possible. And I can think of no situation more favorable than if slave and free, white, black, rich, poor, all, Jews and Greeks, were the followers of Jesus Christ. Because I'm persuaded that if all people loved and knew the Lord Jesus Christ, knew their sins forgiven, knew what it was to have a wonderful master who basically sets us free. He does set us free, doesn't he? The sensation is as if we are free, and yet we are his servants at the same time. So great is his love. And if the world was full of people like that, I know that the conditions of those who are at the extremes of our societies and economies would live very, very different lives to the lives they are sadly, realistically destined, it seems, to live. To live and die in misery. And that's a terrible, terrible thing. So let the preaching of Christ continue. Let the preaching of Christ continue. But there will be some people who will live out their lives effectively as slaves, and they will die in that condition. But if they know Christ, when they go, I know this is a small concession, and I'm not trying to sweeten the pill, but it's a fact that when they go, they will go up to be with him. They will know what it is to call blessed release, sweet release, to have the prison doors fly open. And that is something. That is at least something, isn't it? And it's something that will last forever and ever and ever. I know I probably haven't touched on the whole thing, contradicted, offended you, I have no idea. But it's a difficult, complex subject. But at least I hope I've aired it with you tonight. Enough already is my usual conclusion to a sermon.